How do I establish a film lab in 2013 at the point when everybody thinks it's dead and encourage people to believe that it's still an option and that there's still a reason for shooting on film?
Hello and welcome to the Now Then podcast. In this episode, we speak to Adrian Bull, CEO and founder of CineLab London. We discuss his journey into the industry, the evolution of film, and how he set up the company. Adrian has worked on projects such as Poor Things, James Bond, and Star Wars, just to name a few. This episode is sponsored by Smoke and Mirrors. Hope you enjoy.
Now then, Adrian.
Now then.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I think.
Let's see where we get to, yeah.
Let's see how this goes.
Yeah. I was just saying, just to bring people up to speed, I were out last week at a pub and having a drink with Harvey at Dog Eat Dog, and then bumped into you, Adrian, having a lovely chat about motorbikes and how many you've got in your garage. We were comparing bikes last week, as you do.
Yeah, yours has got smaller and smaller, though, hasn't
you? Yeah, my collection's got smaller and smaller. and then so it turns out, Adrian, so you're the CEO of CineLab.
Indeed, yes.
I were interested in how all that came about, really.
I guess it's a pretty bizarre situation in that I started in the industry in the late 80s working for the British Film Institute, and it was one of those weird things. I was supposed to go to university to study architecture, did that classic 11th hour, bailed and decided I was going to take a year out and go travelling. My dad said, that's fine, you can go travelling, but I'm not paying for it, so you better get a job first. And ended up just completely fluking working for the British Film Institute in my first job. And they were in Dean Street at the time. It wasn't glamorous at all. I was picked up a job as a van driver. But at 18 years old, with a brand new Ford Transit van in Soho, you know, the world literally was like, oh my gosh, this is like a dream job. I've got a brand new van and all I have to do is drive around Soho. And it became pretty obvious to me that there wasn't an awful lot to that job. I had to pick up the van in the morning, drive across to Rathbone Place where print and production was, drive down to the South Bank to drop some stuff off at the vaults at the NFT, and then come back. And I think on my first day, I'd picked up the van at 9 o'clock, got back at 10:15, and literally got a slap round the back of the head for making the job last an hour and 15 minutes. I should have been turning up at 12 o'clock. It was like, and that was sort of a weird one, because you all of a sudden realise sometimes you just get paid to do the job and you don't need to do more than that. And as long as you get the job done, doesn't matter what happens around the rest of it. And, you know, initially for the first few days, you could waste your time driving around, but you can't spend so long driving around aimlessly doing nothing. So the only place that I had to stop really was down at the South Bank. And what I was interested in was what was going on down there with projection and the vaults and everything. And, you know, they had Steenbecks running. So I just, you know, literally within week one was sitting there learning how to lace film on a Steenbeck to review stuff, because I had hours to kill during my working day as a van driver. Within 3 weeks, I'd been offered a job as a film technician, and that was sort of quite bizarre. So I ended up taking a full-time job with the BFI down there. And I guess that was the start of my sort of fascination and interest in film. I was there for 3 years, but saw the progression of digital, or not digital, but video and high definition, and decided that actually the future wasn't film. The future very much was video. And as video got better and was moving towards high definition, even then in the late 80s, there was a Genesis concert that was shot in high definition, 1-inch. And I remember seeing a presentation of that thinking, this is going to kill film. This stuff is so good, it's going to get kill film, because it's going to be cheaper, it's going to be quicker, it's going to be easier. So I then went and studied broadcast engineering and came back into the industry, into the sort of traditional TV post industry in the early 90s, and spent an awful long time in that space. working across, you know, building quite a lot of facilities through that time. I mean, so latterly I was CTO for Ascent Media and Deluxe, watching very, very much the demise of film. You know, so Technicolor and Deluxe, you know, they had 100 years history in film, and, you know, it was absolutely what they were founded on.
What were the kind of like atmosphere back then, you know, especially when kind of VHS were kind of coming through and you know, this new way of filming? What were it like back then?
Well, I think what was interesting was just how it made it easier. So, you know, in the early days, you know, bearing in mind sort of Avid is, I guess, the main, you know, mainstay of the industry in terms of a non-linear editor. I watched that transition happen in the early 90s. You know, it was at a company that bought the second Avid in Soho in 1992. And it took a little while for people to get their head around the fact that, you know, in the tape world, it was linear. And if you needed to make an edit, you were committing to that edit on that tape. And if you got to the end of your cut and you decided to want to change a bit in the middle of it, you were limited to that duration. Otherwise, you had to dub the whole thing and go down a generation to be able to reconfirm an edit to pull it all up. So I think the discipline that went around linear editing was really, really strong. But as we moved towards non-linear editing, all of a sudden, what it gave was people the opportunity to be a bit more creative and flexible. And I mean, you know, it's very much akin to the difference between writing a letter with a pen and paper compared to what happened when word processors came in. And now, you know, it's computers, but you can edit infinitely. It doesn't mean that the job happens any quicker, but what it does mean is that you've probably got more opportunity to hone it and end up with a better result. But, you know, it felt like that transition took a really long time. Mm. You know, I was sort of aware of that move then. But realistically, it took another 20 years to get off tape. Yeah. You know, tape in sort of post-production terms came in very much in the 80s. And, you know, there was lots and lots of developments in terms of tape formats over the years. But it wasn't really until the tsunami happened in 2011. You guys might not be aware of this, but there was an earthquake in Japan, a tsunami that hit the Sony factory in, you know, on the coast of Japan, and it basically wiped out their tape manufacturing capability. So back in, this is 2011, it was like March 2011 that happened. All of a sudden, overnight, there was limited supplies in the supply chain, but there was no more manufacturing happening from the factory in Japan. And people were all of a sudden desperate to work out what the solution was to not using tape stock. And this is, you know, this is videotape stock, nothing to do with film. But what it did was, it was the catalyst towards moving to digital distribution, which is pretty much, you know, Soho was full of runners taking tapes around all over the place, and film as well, for, you know, up until relatively recently. And that sort of killed it. It, you know, everybody went to digital and digital delivery and file-based workflows. And it's very rare that you actually see tapes anymore, which is quite incredible, because it's a relatively short period of time that we've transitioned from that.
And sorry, just jumping in on that one as well. So, and just in terms of like you as well, like within the industry. So have you kind of always been interested in the kind of development and process and kind of like, you know, the kind of tactile nature of the film, or is it, have you been, you know, what kind of side have you come from it?
I'm a technology person. I was a broadcast engineer. That's where my interest was. And I guess it was always about getting involved in the latest, you know, new things. So DVD in the mid-90s, compression, our first DIs we were doing in the early 2000s. We did King Arthur, I think. Not the last King Arthur, but the first King Arthur. I don't know when the first King Arthur was, but in this, you know, the King Arthur we worked on back then was 2000, 2001. And that was one of the first digital intermediate features that we worked on. you know, the development of digital cameras was something that always interested me. So I've just, you know, I've got an unhealthy collection of both digital cameras as well as film cameras.
And motorbikes.
And motorbikes. And bicycles. And yeah,
but it goes on. It's funny you're into, like, you know, the future and technology, but then running in a film lab, which I find quite interesting.
And I think that aspect of it comes from sort of, you know, 2010s, sort of moving towards a bit of digital fatigue. We talk about it quite a bit now, but, you know, I think the bit that's overwhelming for people working now is just the, you know, emails, WhatsApps, social media, all of that sort of stuff, which is quite overwhelming and a bit of an overload. And it's a, you know, it's such a significant demand on your time. And I guess sort of late 2000s, early 2010s, I was just, you know, to be honest, getting bored with, you know, having teams writing asset management software yet again and trying to optimize digital workflows for multi-platform content distribution and syndication and all of that stuff. And all, you know, it was almost going back to the film thing was just like a reset for me. It was like, actually, the reason why I'm in the industry was because I was cared about the creative aspect of making stuff. And I felt like I'd become so far removed from that, that when, you know, it was a challenge as well. So, you know, I was within Deluxe at the point when that decline was really, really significant. You know, from 2010 to 2013, it fell off a cliff. And it was digital cinema that did that. So, you know, most of it wasn't about people shooting on film. It was about the distribution of film prints. And that's where the labs made their money. That's where Technicolor and Deluxe made the large proportion of their revenue, because like 95% of their lab revenue came from making prints. So the moment that switched towards digital cinema, that part of the business just imploded. But the casualty of it was that it made it difficult for them to sustain the labs just to provide front-end processing to support people who wanted to shoot on film. So around that time, I guess my initial thing was, I've had enough of the industry. I just want to get out. I want to go and be a postman up in, you know, by the seaside somewhere or whatever. And over the course of...
So is this before... This is before...
This was before
Cine Lab. Before you started Cine Lab, yeah.
Yeah, so this was...
Don't want to jump the gun here. I'm just trying. So was, what year are we on now? This is like...
This is 2012.
2012,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so cool. I'd resigned from Deluxe, had a very, very long notice period, which I felt like a year was enough time for me to work out what I was going to do next. And during that period, I went from thinking, I'm getting out of this business completely because I've sort of just had enough. I'd had 25 years worth of film and TV post-production and felt like I'd lived through quite a lot of the heyday of it. And then watching what was happening on the lab side of things with it literally sort of imploding, and Kodak were in Chapter 11 at the time. They were in, you know, dire straits because of the such a significant drop-off in the demand for film. And I think I sort of rather foolishly thought, here's a really, really big challenge here. How do I establish a film lab in 2013 at the point when everybody thinks it's dead and encourage people to believe that it's still an option and that there's still a reason for shooting on film? And, you know, I think back to what our arguments were then and compared to now, it's just film's different. Film's different, that's what it is. You know, digital has caught up in terms of resolution, in terms of dynamic range, in terms of quality, but it doesn't look like film. And film has that organic aesthetic that people, I think, to be fair, have only over the last sort of 4 or 5 years started to appreciate again and re-engage with. So you've got sort of people in the background that have always been a fan of film, but I think we've had a lot of millennials who weren't familiar with it at all, hadn't grown up with it, it wasn't their main experience, that all of a sudden started to see the difference in it. And actually, Whereas our focus back in 2013 was to make sure that the old guard, who had always shot on film, knew that there was an option to carry on shooting on film. To a great extent, they didn't really care. You know, they'd had a lifetime of working with film. They'd made loads of films. If it had changed and it was now digital, that wasn't really the end of the world for them. But what we started to see was people who had never worked with film seeing it as the Holy Grail. It's like, you know, I haven't made a film unless I've made a film on film, and I'll do everything I can to get my hands on a film camera and shoot some film. And what's been great is watching people, you know, the realization of how different that looks. But what also goes with it is the discipline of shooting on film, where it does cost money to roll a film camera. So you've got to make sure what you're committing to film is something that you want. You know, you can't trial stuff endlessly unless you've got a lot of money, in the hope that you're going to end up with something that's usable.
True. And I guess from my point of view, so you've got this kind of mammoth of the task of this idea of, you know, starting a film development company. And there's currently only one in the UK, which is Kodak. What's...
Or was there one at that point?
Deluxe and Technicolor much closing. So we knew that they were closing. The plans were already in place for their shutdown. And the shutdown of the Deluxe and Technicolor labs probably happened within a 12-month period globally. I mean, literally, they shut down everything. They sort of held on to some, you know, they relocated and centralized processing to particular locations to try and hold on to what they could.
That's how damaging it was.
But it's crazy that you then saw an opportunity to do your own. Like, how do you convince people to come on board with you?
Did you do? Where did you start it?
I watched a lot of tumbleweed blow past my office for months on end, thinking, "What the hell have I done?"
Because where do you start on something like that? What do you do?
It is step by step. It's, you know, I remember in the first 6 months, you know, we had pitched on a number of films, and one of the biggest difficulties is no one wants to be the first. No one wants to commit to using a new lab for their project when there's no track record or history. And to be fair, I remember thinking on the first couple of things that we were pitching for at sort of towards the end of 2013, almost in the background, keeping my fingers crossed that we weren't going to get them, because it was one of those things. It's like, if we do this at the moment, we're not ready for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it could be absolutely catastrophic for us to take something on and not deliver. And one of the things that I felt really, really important was that it was about getting the right team of people together. What we were lucky with is, you know, we could pull together a lot of experienced people that had been leaving those operations and had, you know, 20, 30 years worth of experience in the industry. And then I guess our first film was Suffragette.
Oh, cool. Oh,
wow. Which, directed by Sarah Gavron and Eddie Grau shot. And I can remember coming off a call on a Friday afternoon where the finances behind it had pretty much said, we don't know who CineLab is. So we'd rather go with... So actually at the time, the only lab really that was actively processing dailies was iDailies. And that was a team of people who I'd worked with before as well. They'd worked with me at Soho Images and Soho Film Lab. In Soho also, and they'd set up in Poland Street here, pretty much across the road. So they had been, you know, over a very short period, over a couple of years, had been sort of taking on the mantle of trying to provide those services. We were in competition with them against it. And just by chance, one of the EPs on the distribution list for Suffragette was someone that I'd worked with quite extensively before. And when I saw her name on the distribution list, I literally got off the tube at home on a Friday afternoon at like 4:30 and called her up and said, CineLab's me. It's like, this is my company. We need to do this film. You know, what I promise you is we will do whatever it takes to deliver it, and you'll know that we'll deliver it. I just need you to trust us. And that was probably the February 2014. And she literally on the phone, it's like, leave it with me, I'll get this sorted out.
Wow.
And, you know, it's always, the industry is, you know, the one thing that you know about this industry, it is about relationships.
Yeah.
You know, it is so, so much easier to make things happen if you've got relationships with people, and you need to leverage them, you need to call on them. But, it's an ecosystem of interdependence. And, you know, despite what people see, you know, within the post-production world and within the production world, in terms of seemingly what looks like fierce competition between all of these companies, under the hood, there's always been a level of collaboration where there's sort of conversation about, you know, how to solve problems and how to get around things. And I guess my time in Soho from an engineering perspective was always about developing that network. It was about talking to people. It was really easy to go down the pub at the end of the day and meet with half a dozen people from half a dozen other post facilities and chat about what the latest problems are and how you're getting around them, and comparing notes on a new bit of kit that was problematic and how we're actually going to get together and sort out the manufacturer who's claiming to have no knowledge of the problem at all. It's that sort of thing. So, you know, again, you know, just going back to Suffragette, it was our sort of first break, and it was a great, great film that, you know, we were very lucky to do as our first one. Once you've got the first one under your belt, then, you know, the second one's still a challenge. You've still got to encourage people to believe that it wasn't a one hit wonder, and you can do it again, and you can do it reliably. And I guess, you know, the big break for us was 2015 when we did Star Wars. So I didn't really think that.
Is that two years after you started then?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was The Last Jedi, which shot in 2015. And I can remember, you know, the original plan around starting CineLab in 2013 was that we felt that there was this sort of long tail of people that might still want to shoot film. And we felt like we might have 5 years left in it. And that probably after a 5 year period, we'd probably need to assume that no one was going to shoot film anymore. And the plan was to sort of fully migrate to being an archive restoration business. You know, everything that had been shot on film still being remastered. It's, you know, content that's shot on film's been remastered God knows how many times, but fundamentally you're still going back to the original film, which has this intrinsic quality to it that, you know, that TV and streamers have only sort of just recently caught up with. You know, being able to deliver 4K content, knowing that 30 or 40 or 50 year old film has 4K resolution locked in it in the first place, but no one's necessarily ever seen it. So being able to remaster at 4K now and restore to a really, really high level means that anybody that shot on film has a very, very valuable asset. And you look by comparison at stuff that was shot in the early 90s on standard definition Digibeta, and it's, you know, there are tools for up-resing and all that sort of stuff, but it's still consigned to being standard definition video that you're tricking into making look better than it was. But the break with Star Wars, you know, we never thought that within a 2 year period we'd be doing major studio features. You know, very much aware that the studios were trying to push away from shooting on film because of the perceived cost of shooting on film. But also the recognition that there was some risk associated with it, in that the, you know, the mainstay of the industry for the last 100 years with Deluxe and Technicolor just weren't doing this anymore. So, you know, I always remember the frustration sort of in the mid, 2010s with conversations with people where they said, yeah, but there aren't any proper film labs anymore. And it's like, you feel like strangling them. It's like, no, there are proper film labs. And actually, having worked on the inside of those operations and knowing the scale of those operations, what we've actually created is something where everything that comes through the facility we care about. And, I don't think I'm harming anyone by saying this. You know, with those big labs of Technicolor and Deluxe, they cared about the volume. They cared about cranking 20,000 prints out for a Harry Potter film and getting that out around the world, because that was $20 million worth of revenue. And the front end aspect of it, shooting it, that might have been $500,000 revenue, was just, you know, it was the bit that they had to do, not the bit that they'd want to do given a choice. Because also that's the critical bit. That's the bit, you know, when you've got a production that's costing $250,000 a day to shoot because of all of the actors that are involved, and the location and the special effects and whatever's going on, everything you're committing to that film, and that film has to work. And, you know, there'd be countless stories of, you know, what's gone wrong over the years historically with that. But the thing that I sort of instilled within the team as we were developing it within CineLab was, if you're unsure about anything, you don't do it. You wait. I can always talk to a client and say, we're going to be late delivering something. That's an awful lot easier as a conversation than we've screwed up your neck.
Yeah.
So, you know, regardless of the pressure that you often get against those deadlines, is it's like, we always do the right thing and we'll be late rather than wrong. And it, you know, it takes a while to get that sort of ethos changed. And if you can imagine, in as it was in the old days with the labs, with the volume of stuff that was going through, they couldn't afford to hold things up. They'd just have to crank the handle and continue to churn it out. And if some stuff went wrong, it was like, okay, it's gone wrong. We'll deal with it. But what we need to do is carry on cranking the handle, because otherwise the other jobs are going to be affected as well. I mean, interesting times.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the biggest things is, over the last 6 or 7 years, is teaching our clients how that works as well. So it's, you know, it's great that you've been down to the lab and you've seen what we're up to, because, again, this was something that was the labs were historically quite protective about. The labs didn't particularly want people nosing around seeing what was going on.
Do you offer that quite a lot then, to kind of come in and see how it all works? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we have had, I mean, I can't think of, I'd love to know how many people we've had come around the lab. And I think back to those first couple of years where, you know, no one wanted to come to Slough to come and have a look around a film lab. And, you know, we've got tours going on probably pretty much every day of people coming down. And often it's, you know, often it'll be a runner that's coming down on a production and it's the, you know, the first week or two of production, and they've come into the lab a few times and they're sort of curious. You know that they're starting their journey in the industry. And it's like, so if you're curious, we can show you around. And, you know, for so much of it, it's about giving people confidence and understanding what happens behind that curtain. You know, my feeling about it is there's, you know, there, it's not, we're in smoke and mirrors, yeah. but you know, it shouldn't be smoke and mirrors. It should be about us, you know, being able to explain what the process is, how it works, why it works like that, what's important as a loader or assistant in terms of making sure there's information that's coming through the lab that we'll, you know, we will be acting on and responding to. And I think that's what helps give people the confidence to go, actually, I really like this, I understand it, and yeah, I want to shoot film again.
Because I think the fear is, if you don't understand it, that's the fear. Like, oh, I don't understand it, therefore I won't touch it, especially if you've never touched it before.
Yeah.
But who do you think's like the key, like, head of department, who's the one who you feel like is, if they have an understanding, that they can push it through? Because obviously, like, when I speak to DOPs, they all would prefer to shoot on film. But sometimes, for me, the battle is the money aspect or the producer not fully understanding it.
Yeah.
So who for you is the main...
So I think typically you need a you typically need a DP and a director that are behind it. If you haven't got their commitment, you're going to have a struggle. Invariably, the producers probably don't want to shoot film. You know, they're the ones that are managing the budget, that are conscious of the spend, and typically frightened of it getting out of hand. But luckily, I guess one of the things that's really nice is the, you know, the nature of shooting on film means it tends to attract people who care quite a lot about what they're doing. It's really easy for us to dismiss the sort of digital, you know, indiscriminate digital capture, which is leave the camera rolling and see what sticks. I can't any longer be sort of disparaging about digital, but I always quite enjoyed teasing people by, you know, when they were talking about budgeting and they weren't sure whether they were going to shoot film or digital. You'd love using the word video. Oh, so you're making a video. and you could just see people's heckles, you know, like, it's not a video, it's a film. It just happens to be a digital camera. I'd love to do a campaign to say it can't be called a film if it's not shot on film. It's got to be called a movie or a, you know. But we are doing digital productions, and, you know, we've done some pretty significant digital productions. So it's really about embracing all of it now.
Well, that was another question, actually, Ozzy, because I know you've been printing some of your digital work onto film.
Mm.
I've not done it yet, actually.
Pull your finger out.
Does it really look like film?
So this had been a dilemma for me for some time. The first project we did was a Paolo Nutini video that Ian Pons-Jewell directed back in probably end of 2013, early 2014. It was probably shot on an Alexa at the time, and we recorded it back to film, printed it, scanned it, and that's what got delivered. It's a video that's got Joanna Lumley in it. And the transformation of a very, very clean digital image to going through that film process and it doing a really good job of emulating film, I always sort of felt, you know, what I was torn with was, it was like, well, this is to some extent fraudulent because we're doing a really good job of making it look like it was film. But what we need to be careful of is cannibalizing our business. Mm. You know, yeah. We want people to shoot on film given the choice. Yeah. And probably the change to that was 3 or 4 years ago when we started to provide digital services. So during the COVID period, we were working very closely with a couple of guys, Simon Chubbuck and Joshua Callis-Smith, who owned a company called Onset Tech. And we ended up merging them. And it was like we'd worked on a few projects together collaboratively where, you know, even on film projects, there's sometimes a digital component. And we'd worked on Last Night in Soho together, and it had been a really good experience and relationship. And it made sense for us to join forces and just get on with it and say, okay, so if you come to Cine Lab, you can do everything. Doesn't matter whether you shoot on film, doesn't matter whether you shoot on digital, all the stuff comes to us and we deal with it. And the obvious step at that stage was, well, if we're now supporting people who shoot on digital, if for practical reasons, logistical reasons, if you're in a, you know, if you're in a faraway land and you haven't got access to flights to get film back to us and whatever, and you're forced to shooting digital, then if you want to go through this process, then we've got a really, really neat solution for taking digital acquired source, recording it back to film, rescanning it, and it looking quite convincingly like it could have been shot on film. Right. I mean, it is real film. You know, there's loads and loads of people messing around with textures, with digital grain solutions. We're pretty much keeping an eye on all of them all of the time, because obviously it's a bit of a concern for us. But, you know, the number of sort of side-by-side tests that we've done where you sort of say to people, well, you've just got to choose in context what's the right thing for you. You know, if it's something that's going to end up on the big screen, you need to look at it on the big screen. And whatever tests you're doing, make sure you look at them on the big screen. If it's something that's going to be a music video that people are going to watch on their TV or on their mobile phone, then look at it in that context and see whether you can see the difference and choose what you think is the right solution for it. But often we refer to it very crudely. And again, it's one of those things I sort of cringe a little bit about. We call it DFD, which crudely stands for digital to film to digital. And it was one of those things that we started internally using as the sort of abbreviation for it ourselves 3 or 4 years ago. And then all of a sudden started to realise clients were asking us for DFDs because, you know, it just got out. And we tried to come up with some elaborate brand name for this service that was going to be clever and whatever. And it's like, guys, just forget it. Just let's stick with DFD.
Any DFDs, mate?
So you need your DFDs. Music
videos. I can't wait to drop you an email after this.
Commercials as well, right? A lot of commercials.
Music videos, commercials. But we've actually got, we've got quite a few features. We've got 3 features that have all been on Netflix. That have gone through the process. We've got a couple of episodics that have gone through the process. At the moment, we're in testing with 5 films that are likely to go through the process as well. It's sort of quite transformative. At the end of last year, there was a film released, The Society of the Snow, which was about the plane crash in Chile in the 70s with the rugby team on board. And J.A. Bayona, you know, typically would always want to shoot film. The logistics on that, it was a 145-day shoot in some pretty extreme conditions in the mountains in Chile. You know, there was no way practically it was going to shoot on film. But the transformation of that going through the process of taking, you know, we know what digital content looks like. We know what digital content's like, particularly with responding to highlights. So when you've got white out snow scenes where you've just got, you know, clipping of highlights in the snow and there's no variation on a frame by frame basis, it's not particularly engaging. And when you put it through the process and every frame becomes different by virtue of the fact that that grain, which is truly random on every frame, it just brings something back to it. And the grain, you know, grain's about a variation in density and colour within that, within the
image.
And well done. I've forgotten the word for those pictures that we're looking at. But it just transforms it. And, you know, there's this, you know, Walter Murch frames this really, really well. And I sat in a meeting with him about 10 years ago when I first heard him say it, which was, you know, if you shoot a static image on digital, it looks like the action's finished. Whereas if you shoot a static image on film, it looks like something's about to happen. And that's just the fact that there's something always happening with film. There's always that subtle movement. You know the image hasn't frozen. And for Society of the Snow, where you've got these big landscapes with whiteouts and you know, clipped highlights in a lot of the cases, just adding that film grain over the top of it just gave it some more interest. But, you know, there's a tremendous amount of makeup, you know, it, within that, with people's really sort of craggy faces and everything. And again, when you did the side-by-side of the digital against the film just added a texture to it that gave it, you know, an emotion.
Well, there's them stories as well, you know, where people, we've had the conversations about why people connect with certain films. And, you know, one of the answers is because it's shot on film and it has a certain texture, you know, a certain feel to it that we just connect to rather than something shot on digital. Is there truth in that?
I have to say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have a...
I concur.
I think it's, you know, as I said, you know, I can remember in the early, you know, in the early days, talking to people about 4K, saying to people, well, of course, if you shoot on film, you can deliver 4K. Now, for probably the first 2 or 3 years, no one was really interested in it. Although 4K was a thing back in 2013, no one really had the budgets to deliver 4K, and it wasn't being mandated. And it wasn't really until, you know, the streamers started to really push it and saying, no, you need to be 4K acquisition and 4K through your pipeline and 4K delivery, otherwise we don't want it, that started to impact properly on it. And that was probably around 2016-17 we started to see that uptick in the demand for 4K. I think bizarrely what happened with that is at 4K resolution it finally did a job of representing what film looked like, because the resolution of film grain is way above HD resolution or 2K. So when you digitized a bit of film on HD or 2K, as much as you'd see the grain, you didn't see the detail of grain. And at 4K, you're starting to see higher resolution grain, which is more akin to the film if you were seeing the film projected photo, you know, from a photochemical, you know, piece of film. And I think that's one of the advantages of film with us moving towards digital at 4K, is that people are seeing the, you know, the true essence of it. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things at the other end of the spectrum is sort of Super 8. You know, we've seen a phenomenal return and revival with Super 8, and we've put a lot of effort into that. There's a great competition that we're involved in.
Straight 8.
Which is Straight 8 with Ed Sayers and Alex Glynn, who, you know, Ed founded it 25 years ago. We've been involved in it since it relaunched, I think, 7 years ago now. And everybody's memory of Super 8 is, you know, my memory of Super 8 in the sort of 80s, 90s, was always this very, very poor quality stuff that would typically, you'd shoot on film, you'd take it to a local locksmith's because for some reason, you know, transferring cine film to video was something that locksmiths specialised in doing. You know, it was like, get your cine transfers here. Where literally the film was projected onto a wall and captured on a video camera, a VHS camera or whatever. They might have managed to put it onto a DVD, but it was pretty poor resolution. And, you know, it had the worst of everything in what you would see. You look at that stuff now, scanned at 2K or 4K resolution, and the pictures are really quite magical. And I don't defy anybody to look at something that's caught on Super 8 and not smile. You know, it's, if ever there was a format that had a really, really strong positive emotion associated with it, it's Super 8. It's really quite bizarre. And it doesn't matter that the picture jumps around a little bit and maybe it might be out of focus, and it might have some scratches on it and a bit of dirt and a bit of sparkle. The underlying images are, you know, really quite emotional.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's been great seeing people at a real, real low level, entry level, be able to buy cameras off eBay for 30 quid, put a roll of film in it, shoot something, and end up with something where every bit of it they want.
It weirdly feels honest. It's so much more honest than if you're seeing, like, even if we'll see like old phone footage from 10 years ago. It's weird what it does to you internally.
I feel like already for me, I look through a period of the 90s and early 2000s and realised I went through the sort of dark ages of capture, where I'd gone from, you know, as a teenager and in my early 20s using a 35mm stills camera and having medium format as well, where, you know, if you shoot medium format, literally every picture you ever capture on medium format you want.
Just in terms of like projects that you've worked on, film, TV, is there any kind of like special ones that, you know, kind of you hold close to your heart?
So again, sort of going back to 2013 when we started this, I think we always thought we'd appeal to the independents. And it was like, okay, this will give the independents a chance to carry on shooting film. You can't not feel proud about doing a Star Wars or a Bond film or a Mission Impossible, or, you know, all of those are like major milestones. It's like to have, you know, such a strong film franchise with your name associated with it. And, you know, in often cases, like half the people in the company with credits on the film. And I know, you know, they're amongst a cast of thousands of credits on films. But you know, that's pretty special. In the digital space, we've done, you know, probably the biggest projects budget-wise that have gone through the UK. So,
ain't it crazy? You've been going, what, 10 years? And then the first 2 or 3 years, it just... We were talking about our industry the other day, weren't we? And it's just like there's no kind of linear, you know, line. It's not like, you know, I guess in a lot of other professions, it's kind of like you start off low and you work up the ladder. But with our industry, it is a very roller coaster industry, you know. Like you said, built on relationships and built on a lot of things. But ain't that crazy how well you've done? That's
great. Yeah, and actually the thing that I love the most is the diversity of the clients that we work with. So, you know, genuinely, if you go and shoot a roll of Super 8, you've got the same team. You know, this isn't, we've not got tiers of people that work on particular projects. The lab guys work on everything that comes through the lab. The digital dailies guys work on everything that comes through the lab. The scanning guys, the colorists, you know, they're all working on everything. So you can shoot literally a roll of Super 8 and you've got the same attention to detail and service that a major studio feature would get. And you can't, you know, there's no, you can't differentiate on quality. Yeah. You can't turn around and go, oh, because that's only a small job and it's only, we're going to do it at a different level. It's, you've got to work to the highest standard always. And luckily everybody benefits from that. You know, and you see that, you know, when you've got someone who's shot, you know, two rolls of 16 mil film for their, you know, project that they've self-financed and they walk through the door, you can see them feeling almost overwhelmed by the fact that they're actually putting something through a process alongside, you know, a Wes Anderson film or, you know, Noah Baumbach or, you know, it's quite special.
So where do you see from now, where do you see it in the next 10 years? Film.
Crumbs.
It's hard. Yeah, it's great. I guess it's hard because a lot's gone through it in the past 10 already.
Yeah. And I, you know, go back to something I said earlier. I didn't think we'd be in a situation now where people are shooting more film than they have done previously. The bit that's been really surprising, which is quite a significant change, is the amount of stuff that's going back to print. So I think we've probably have made more 35 mil prints in the last 18 months than we had done in the previous 9 years put together. And that's I think people wanting to go to the cinema and see something different. You know, one of the challenges with digital cinema distribution is you're seeing essentially something that's not too far removed from what you can see in your own home with a decent 4K OLED display. You know, there's no difference in the resolution of what you're seeing. It's just about the size of the image and whether you're seeing it with an audience of 100 people or 200 people alongside you and around you to share the experience. And, you know, encouraging people to go to the cinema because they're seeing a 35 mil print, which they can't see in their home. I know a few people that could show 35 mil in their home, but that's not really the norm. They're quite special, those people.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can imagine.
I can. Yeah.
Good people to know, I think.
But it looks, it just looks different. There is, again, a different feeling to seeing a 35 mil print projected compared to digital. And again, it's one of those things that probably for the last 10 years, an awful lot of teenagers have come through never having seen 35 mil film projected. So, you know, that's definitely something I'd like to see, you know, continuing and coming back and sort of encouraging as many places as possible where they've got a 35 mil projector that's just been mothballed to try and get it up and running again to embrace that.
Because how many cinemas do it in? I know Prince Charles does it.
Yeah.
Is there any? I can't think
We've got some of the picture houses have got 35 mil projection.
All right, wow.
It is pretty limited. We've obviously got, you know, Leicester Square's got a few cinemas that can still do 35 as well. And obviously 70 mil has had quite a significant revival in the last few years.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not going to become the mainstay because of the inevitable. There is a high cost associated with 35 mil print distribution. So it's not going to become the mainstay. But I think people will search out those few cinemas that are running 35 mil to go and actually see something. In terms of the rest of the outlook, I think, my hope is Kodak carry on making film. You know, that's probably one of our big risks, is that manufacturing continues. But in Europe, there's a lot of interest in shooting film as well. Scandinavia is a really strong territory for shooting film. Germany does quite well. Italy does quite well. France, you know, again, is it's really popular, still shooting on film. UK is the biggest market for it, but then UK always has been in terms of film and TV post-production anyway for Europe. But I guess, you know, what we've done over the last few years is sort of try and make the process as efficient as possible. You know, there's a lot of digital stuff that goes around film anyway. So in terms of, you know, dailies delivery for screeners, you know, electronic file delivery for the editorial file straight into production, that all speed up the process and make it easier for people to work with it. And it's really about giving people the confidence to understand that, you know, the one thing that I find frustrating, often we'll have a producer or a, you know, line producer come to us and they're talking about budgeting for a project. And it will often start with, I haven't done a film project for 10 years, so you're going to have to help me with this because I might not know the details of everything. What that invariably means is, I haven't done a film project for 10 years, and even when I did it for 10 years ago, I didn't understand what was going on and I didn't understand what all these things meant. But actually, we're in a better position now than ever to be able to, because we do everything in one location, we're in a better position to not only describe it, but be able to show it and demonstrate it, to give people an understanding of how that is. But what I just hope is that people, you know, continue to have the confidence to use it and embrace it.
I think we're rattled through there.
Yeah, that was great.
It's been a great insight to get you on, and I'm so glad I bumped into you the other night. This is such a rare opportunity, I think, to get open up a conversation like this. And I know that people in our industry are going to be really curious to listen to it. So
definitely.
I've learned a lot as well today.
And spur people on to shoot some film.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a little tour as well, actually. I'm going to get one of them booked in.
Come down, by all means. It's
question, actually, as well. I was thinking this as you were talking. Do you have, like, a little private cinema at CineLab, by any chance?
We do.
I thought you might do, yeah.
Don't tell him that.
Is that a 35mm projector?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
I'll drop you a little email and we'll sort of smile.
Very, very lucky to
got my birthday coming up soon.
To benefit from having a private cinema in Slough.
Great.
And the Elizabeth line has been transformative in terms of getting people more easily down to the lab.
Yeah.
So by all means, jump on the Lizzie line from Soho.
Great.
40 minutes later, you'll be in a lab.
Amazing.
Love it.
Lovely. Oh, well, thanks so much for coming on.
Nice one. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, guys.
See you soon. Bye.